wants me to introduce.
Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. We have a full agenda today, and we are going to start out by our somewhat semi-annual process of introducing committee bills. As we all know, the introduction of committee bills by a committee does not indicate support or opposition to those bills. We do this to keep the process moving along. The bills that you have, the LC drafts that you have in front of you, a lot of them are tax credit bills, and then there are a number of bills that have been suggested either by our staff or by other offices, and we will get them in the process by introducing them today. So, Senator Bertschinger, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move that the following bills be introduced as committee bills in the 2015 session. LC 1015, LC 1408, LC 1409, LC 1410, LC 1411, LC 1412, LC 1413, LC 1414, LC 1415, LC 1416, LC 1417, LC 1418, LC 1419, LC 1420, LC 1421, LC 1422, LC 1424, LC 1425, LC 1426, LC 1525, LC 1526, LC 1769, LC 1770, LC 1771, LC 1772, LC 1773, LC 1774, LC 1775, LC 2220, and LC 2246.
Very well done, Senator Bertschinger. So Senator Bertschinger has moved that the aforementioned LC drafts be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Okay, now we will move on to the substance of our agenda, starting with a discussion of the clean air tax and fee feasibility study final report. And we have in our audience today some esteemed visitors from Catlin Gable School. And it's Mr. Walsh's globalization class that is here. And they have taken on the carbon tax issue or the clean air tax issue as a class project, met with them extensively today. This is their third hearing today on the subject, and they're still all awake as near as I can tell. They have presented very substantive emails to my office. They are gathering a petition that they're having young people sign because the issue of climate change is so critical to the coming generation, and they're taking it very seriously. So I want to welcome them to this hearing, and we may actually have some of their questions asked after we hear our presentation. So welcome to the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, and we are thrilled to have you here. So, Dr. Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple introductory comments about the report. You've received updates on it throughout the progress. This is a result of Senate Bill 306, which you passed in the 2013 session. As you recall, we were appropriated $200,000 to conduct the study. And what we did was we used the vast majority of that to contract out with the Northwest Economic Research Center. We've been working very closely with them all along. Mazin has been the project manager and has spent very many hours working on this. Christine and also, even though he's with us only a short period of time, Vijay have also put in a lot of work and effort into this project. So, and I did want to mention one other person that helped us, a former Legislative Revenue Office employee, and who we contracted with because of his knowledge in this type of modeling, Zed Waters, and add this help guide us through this. But especially thank Tom Patowski and his crew at the Northwest Economic Research Center, who have done been very cooperative and put in a lot of time and effort, and they had to put up with Mazin for a long time, and so they've done very well at that. So I'll ask Tom to come up with his team to brief you on the report.
Great, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the House. Members of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Patowski. I am director of the Northwest Economic Research Center at Portland State University and a professor of economics also at PSU. With me today is Dr. Jenny Liu, assistant director at NERC and an assistant professor of urban studies and planning at PSU. Also, Jeff Renfro, NERC senior economist. Dr. Chris Butenhoff, PSU assistant professor of physics, and Dr. Andrew Rice, PSU associate professor of physics. And I also want to mention one other researcher that was from NERC that was an author on this study, Michael Paraskevich. All right, Paul already filled you in a little bit on the background. I won't spend too much time on this. What I will talk about is where we started in the process in October of 2013, and now just a little over a year finishing the project. And just draw your attention to the green bullet points here. We weren't doing this study in a vacuum, just looking at our computers in our offices. We worked with many different groups. We met monthly with LRO, and especially with Mazin. We had a technical advisory committee meetings made up of various, mainly state agencies. You can find that list of members on page one of the report. We met with various stakeholder groups, from utilities to businesses to labor groups, advocacy groups from environmental to low income to business associations. And then also we provided you with a number of updates as we were going along, and then basically met weekly with LRO staff in the last sort of 2 months of the study. So, Jeff, very briefly, you know, the purpose that we're trying to look at here is a particular type of way of limiting carbon emissions. You're all familiar with the regulatory controls that you have in the state, things like the renewable portfolio standards, clean fuel programs, energy siting standards for utilities, and these are tend to be very specific have a particular goal as to the type of possible emission reductions that is being asked for, or possibly the emission reduction is sort of an indirect result of what the regulatory standard is asking for. And in that sense, there may be, in our minds, lower cost ways of getting to reducing emissions. And those fall under the aspects of what we call market mechanisms. The two most well-known are the carbon cap and trade and the carbon tax. And so today we're going to talk about the carbon tax. You know, when something does not have a price to it, it tends to be either overproduced or overused. You know, when I was state economist, I gave talks, and I could not charge for the talks. So we would have, like, daycare centers calling us up that we could come by for a couple of hours. You know, it was just because we were free and we were being overused. And so it's really tough then to have that resource, our time, be used efficiently. Now that I'm at PSU, I actually charge for my talks. I'll just say on the side that this money is set aside for student interns to be hired at NERC. But the calls are less. The groups that do call us up are very specific about what they want us to do. And so both our use of time and so on, I think, are much more efficiently used. And the purpose of what we're doing is much more to the point rather than just filling in some program when we were free. So with that, it's really we're trying to put a price now on something that does not have a price, so that this externality is internalized into decision making. It forms incentives to change behavior through usage by being more efficient with your energy, conservation, alternative energy sources, or investing in energy-saving technologies. And so as such, the actors here, businesses and households, they are seeing the price on the carbon, and they figure out what's the best way in order to avoid using carbon-based fuels. And thus, they should seek out the lowest cost way of doing it. In that sense, it's efficient. Now, very top view of what we're going to be talking about today, we're going to be concentrating on the carbon tax as one particular type of market mechanism to reduce carbon emissions. And if you think this dynamic aspect is in this very simple triangular diagram here, you place a tax on the carbon weight among various fuels. That tax will create carbon tax revenues. And, of course, the tax on the economy also has an impact on businesses and households and how they use energy. Now, if we take those taxes and we say, what should we use them for? There are two main areas we'll talk about today. One is what's called repatriation, and that would be, you know, if I bring in $100 million worth of carbon taxes, can I reduce tax rates on businesses and households by $100 million so that it's basically tax neutral? And what would be that impact on the economy? So the way this whole thing works, or expenditures for that matter, we could use the carbon tax revenue for targeted expenditures, either energy efficiency or for K through 12, depending on what the wishes are of the state. So think of the dynamics. I put on a tax that creates revenues, but also has an impact in the economy. What I do with that tax out in the economy also affects the economy. As the economic landscape changes, that will change the amount of emissions there are. Well, as the emissions change, there's a tax on those emissions. That causes tax revenues. That gets put back in the economy, and you have this sort of circular dynamic aspect at work. So in our scenarios we'll talk about today, just keep that in mind. This is what we're looking at. We're looking at a tax. We're looking at what does that do to emissions? What does that do to tax revenues? How can those revenues be used back in the economy? How does the economy react to all this, and how it then keeps going in a circular dynamic aspect? And I'll turn it over to Dr. Liu.
For the record, my name is Jenny Liu. Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. So this slide that we have here is kind of a top-level view of our methodology and modeling. And before we start, at the top, the SB 306 is structured as a dollar per ton, per metric ton of CO2 equivalent. And we were tasked with looking at what would be the tax base for this, what would be the tax rate for this. So our modeling basically goes through various levels of this carbon tax rate. And we go from the lowest rate of $10 per ton of CO2 equivalent up to $150 per ton of CO2 equivalent to give us an idea of what the different ranges will do to our economy as well as emissions. We look at putting this particular tax on various fuel types, including natural gas, petroleum products, as well as electricity being produced in the state. So basically all fossil fuel combustion that happens in the state, in addition to electricity that is being consumed within the state but is combusted and produced elsewhere. So we do our forecast. So this model actually goes through many iterations, and we have about a 20-year forecast from 2014 out to 2034. Okay. So at the very top level, we have the carbon tax at various levels. And we also have energy forecasts that we obtained from the Energy Information Administration. And all of this is kind of boiled down and customized for our Oregon-specific region into fuel price increases for the various fuels that we were talking about by region and also by various uses. So that feeds into our economic model, which is the REMI model, which divides Oregon into six regions to look at what are the economic impacts. And again, for the REMI model, even though it is a software package, we did a lot of extensive customization to make sure that this REMI model accurately reflects what are the industries that Oregon operates in, what are the outputs from the various industries, to make sure that we have an accurate picture of the economy here. So what comes out of there, with the price increase that is caused by a carbon tax, we are able to calculate what are the changes due to what are the changes to the emissions, and that gets translated into what are the carbon tax revenues we will receive from this particular carbon tax. And then those carbon taxes get used in our revenue usage scenarios that you see on the left-hand side here, which we will go into a little bit more detail about the actual scenarios as well as the results. And you can find all of our scenario results in Appendix 2 of the study. So all the revenue goes into the economy in one way or another, either through tax cuts or investments and various scenarios that Jeff will talk in more detail about. And it cycles through the economy, and it has dynamic effects on the economy. And in the end, what we end up with are our emission impacts on in Oregon, as well as economic impacts that you see on the bottom here. So before we get into the results of what happens with the carbon tax and how you use the various types of revenues, we needed to establish baselines to compare with. So basically what this means is that we needed to establish a forecast of the Oregon economy as well as a baseline for what is happening in the Oregon emissions picture before there is a carbon tax. And that's what we're going to compare to is. So here for the economy, basically economic model with all the policy assumptions that are in place, emissions side, basically we look at what are the policies that regulate various fuel mixes and regulations that Tom had talked about earlier, and we established that baseline to compare everything to. So now I'm going to turn the table over to Jeff to talk about the scenarios.
For the record, I'm Jeff Renfro. So a goal of this project is not to advocate any one particular use of the revenues, but it's rather to present policymakers with a menu of options or a bunch of ideas about what you guys could do with this. And then we look at the impacts on employment, compensation, output, various industries, the impacts across regions and across household income levels, so that all those different policy priorities can be weighed against each other when decisions are being made. So this is a simplified schematic of shows the relationship between the different policy scenarios that we modeled. I would say in Appendix 2 of the report, we have a much more detailed version of this schematic. But we split our scenarios into basically five different groupings. So I want to give you examples of how those groupings fit together. So our A scenarios feature no repatriation. So in the A scenarios, the government collects the revenue, and then it's all used for some sort of government purpose. So what we actually modeled, we looked at what would happen if all of the revenue was put into financial reserves. We think that this is probably not realistic, but we did it for a few different reasons. One reason is if the federal government imposed a carbon tax and the revenues were used in a way that didn't directly benefit Oregon, this might be the impact that we would expect from that. We also, conceptually, we wanted to see what the employment impact was from the front end of the policy, from the increase in the energy prices due to the carbon tax, because we wanted to see what we needed to offset with the revenues on the back end of the policy. In the B scenarios, these are our truly revenue neutral scenarios. So very early in our process, we spoke with legislative counsel. Legislative counsel told us with no ambiguity, carbon tax placed on transportation fuels, that revenue has to go to the Highway Trust Fund. So in this revenue neutral series of scenarios, we take the transportation-related revenues, and we use those to offset existing gas taxes and existing transportation fees. We use the remainder of the revenues to reduce corporate and personal income tax rates. In our C scenarios, we take that transportation revenue and we dedicate it to the Highway Trust Fund, so we model that bit of it. And then the remaining revenues we use for personal and corporate income tax cuts. Also in our C scenario set, we model a citizen dividend, which is sort of like the Alaska oil revenues model. The reason we did this is just about every public meeting or public presentation we've been to in the last year, we get asked about this every time. So there's definitely a lot of interest in the citizen dividend model. Our D scenarios, we're looking at a mix of dedicated revenues to the Highway Trust Fund, some revenues for personal and corporate income tax cuts, but then also setting aside revenues for specific policy goals. So examples of this include extra revenues to offset the negative impact on low-income households, and also worker assistance. We use that to mean when there are industries that are negatively impacted by the tax, could we set aside funds that are directed at offsetting the negative impact of workers who have lost their jobs? We also look at targeted industry support. So this comes in basically two forms. One is a front-end exemption from the tax on industries. Then we also look at what if we didn't exempt them, but we set aside revenues as sort of an investment fund to help offset any potential negative impacts. We also look at using the revenues for energy efficiency projects. And then our last set of scenarios, the E scenarios, we keep the transportation revenue separated from everything else, but instead of just dedicating it to the Highway Trust Fund, we look at alternative transportation expenditures. So an example of this is Highway Trust Fund dollars are distributed based on a weighted VMT or weighted vehicle mile travel calculation. So we went in and we unweighted the VMT calculation. We also looked at using the revenues for investments in transportation-related projects that weren't building and maintaining highways. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chris, and he's going to talk to you about emissions results.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Thank you. For the record, my name is Chris Butenhoff, Assistant Professor of Department of Physics at Portland State University. Jenny, do you want to? Thanks. So, like Jess said, what we want to start doing now is start showing some of our actual results, and we're going to start here with the emissions. So on this plot, what we're going to show will be that the baseline emissions. Again, the baseline emissions are the emissions we expect under a no-carbon tax scenario. And then we're going to show the various emission forecasts for the different carbon tax levels. And just the thing I want to point out, on the left vertical axis will be the emissions in units of million metric tons of CO2 equivalent. And then on the right, we put as a reference the 1990 Oregon emissions. Again, I just want to emphasize that these are the energy-related greenhouse gas emissions. These aren't the complete suite of Oregon emissions. The energy-related emissions are roughly 83% of the total emissions. So the first line you see there, the baseline, under this scenario, again, under a no-carbon tax scenario, we forecast, again, based upon ODOE and U.S. EIA data, that the energy-related emissions in the state of Oregon will increase about 10% over this modeling period. And again, I want to point out that this will actually reflect an increase in emissions. For the past decade, roughly, the energy-related emissions in Oregon have been decreasing roughly 10% since about 2000. Under this scenario, we expect the baseline emissions to be about 15%, about 13 or 14%. Above the 1990 emissions in year 2020. You might recall that Oregon has the goal of reducing its emissions 10% by the year 2020 and 75% by the year 2034. So just to emphasize here under the baseline scenario, Oregon would not meet that goal. And then Jenny, if you want to show the next. And then the next suite of curves, again, are the emissions for the various carbon taxes, starting at $10, going up to $150. Just a couple key points to take away from this graph. At a carbon tax of $10, emissions still do remain above the 1990 level. But for all carbon tax rates, $30 and higher, we do see emissions reductions that would put Oregon's emissions below the 1990 level. And in particular, starting at a tax of $60 per ton or higher, Oregon could actually achieve its 2020 goal of reducing emissions 10% by 2020. Our study only goes out to the year 2034. At that at that year, even at $150, we're still only about 35% below 1990 levels. So the point I just want to emphasize there, that even with a carbon tax, Oregon would probably not be on track to meet its 2050, its more stringent goal of 75% reduction by the year 2050. Go ahead. And this is just a summary of essentially that graph. Again, this is showing the baseline case and the carbon tax scenarios. The leftmost column are the emissions units in millimetric tons of CO2 equivalent. And then we have reductions from the baseline, and then again, change from 1990 levels. So with the $10 per ton carbon tax, we see a reduction of about 4 million metric tons, excuse me, all the way up to about a reduction of about 23 metric tons, and that translates into a reduction of 7% to 42% relative to the baseline. And I think with that, I will turn it over to Andrew to talk about more of the emissions results.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Andrew Rice. Chair Burdick, members of the committee. So we're going to dig a little bit deeper into the emissions before moving on to the economics. Some of the power of our approach was to be able to break out the emissions by region, by economic sector, by fuel type. This slide shows a color-coded breakout of emissions on the map and also the coordinated pie. So this is the baseline case. As you can see, about 60% of the state emissions come from the metro region, with the valley contributing about 20%, southwest 7%, northwest 2%, central 3.5%, and eastern 4%. When we go into the carbon tax scenarios, what you'll notice, is that the size of the pie changes, and that's as we've kind of scaled the size of the pie relative to the emissions. So we're seeing at $30 per ton, again, a 15% decrease. At $60 per ton, we see a 26% decrease, and at 100, we see a 35% decrease. But as you see, the relative areas are pretty much consistent between the regions. So we're seeing reductions across region. There's a very small shift in the metro region, out of the metro into the other regions. You see at the baseline, metro is about 62% of emissions. And then in the $100, it goes down to about 59. This is a very small shift overall, though. Not shown on this graph, but also relevant, is that we see the largest, and also in section two of the results, I refer you to that, we see the largest reductions due to the carbon tax in industrial sector. Industrial emissions will be largest in natural gas and electricity. Residential emissions are second in terms of reductions. Within that category, petroleum for fuels for transportation is the largest. Okay, so let's take a look at moving on to revenues. So each carbon tax scenario produces a revenue projection. Just as a real quick explanation of how we get this, once we have the emissions graphs that Chris showed, you can just multiply that by the tax rate and you have the emissions. And you see kind of two branches emerge here, one for $10, $30, and $45. And then the other branch for 60, 100 to 125, and 150. And that's simply because the tax rate is increased different. In the lower scenarios, it's increased at $5 per ton per year. And in the upper cases, it's at $10 per ton per year. So the revenues project differently. But in any case, if we just go through a couple scenarios here, at a tax rate of $30 per ton, revenue does stabilize at about $1.4 billion. This is very similar to what BC sees at. They are currently at $30 per ton. They've collected about $1.2 Canadian dollars, so it's not apples and apples. At a tax rate of $60 per ton, revenue is about $2.4 billion, and $100 per ton at $3.5 billion. Within this, approximately 35% of the revenue that's collected would come from the residential sector. The other remaining would be split between the industrial and commercial sectors. I just want to point out, finally, which is pretty obvious on the graph, but just to really hit it home here, that once the cap tax rate is reached in each scenario, the revenue stabilizes for the future years that we've modeled. So it varies only within a couple percent. And then if there's more additional information in the revenue projections in section 3 of the results. Thanks.
Okay. I'm not going to spend any time on this slide. This is just kind of a reminder of where Oregon was in 2013 and some stylized data about the economy. But just as sort of a reminder that we were very careful to work with the REMI model to make sure that the model did reflect the Oregon economy and the interactions of our industries that are more unique to our state, and made sure that those were in place. So here we have the baseline outlook. And the baseline outlook is a projection, a forecast of where, in this particular case, it's employment, going out through 2034. And so all laws are in place, regulations, so on. All those are expected to stay in place, what we call business as usual, going out to this forecast. And now what we wanted to do is to frame this. We have all these different scenarios that Jeff went through. And so to frame where it could happen through here, we wanted to choose one scenario that was probably the most negative impact on the Oregon economy, and then maybe another scenario that would be basically the most positive type impact. So at the $100 per ton level, we see... We see that there's very little difference. And now this is the one where the tax is collected and it's not put back in the economy at all. No tax rates are lowered, no expenditures are made. It's just sort of locked away. And so we can just look at that front-end impact of putting a tax on carbon. And basically, this drop here from the baseline is somewhere approximately 35,000, 37,000 jobs, which is slightly more than 1% of the jobs through this forecast. The other thing I want you to keep in mind just looking at this is that this is still positive job growth. I mean, even with the implementation of the tax, it doesn't mean jobs fall. And jobs are still growing over time, but the tax acts as a drag on that growth so that the growth is not as strong as it would be without that particular polar sort of case of putting taxes on. And then the $30 per ton is saying, okay, now all the tax revenue is going to be spent through the general fund. And that gives the strongest impact. But then this, again, is maybe a little less than 1% of an impact across this period of time relative to the baseline case. So the concept I wanted you to take away from this is that all our scenarios that we're looking at, they tend to have, in terms of the overall economy, a relatively mild impact on the economy. I'm not to belittle the fact of modeling that 35,000 job drop is nothing, but really, to an expectation of what you might think this could do to the economy, these are relatively mild impacts. And as we go through the scenarios, we'll see that even though overall the economy is mild, it'll be important to look at the regions, the different industries that are impacted, and the different income levels that are impacted.
So I'm going to talk about some of the economic results. And before I start, I want to say we modeled a lot of different scenarios. So I'm just going to touch on a few. But in the results section of the report and then also in the second appendix, we have detailed employment, output, compensation, and industry impacts. So anything we've talked about today, you can look at the results in as much detail as you'd like. So this is a summary table from our executive summary. And we've split the impacts out into each one of our scenario groups. So you can see, as Tom said, scenario A includes our financial reserve and then our all general fund expenditure scenarios. So that's where we see our extremes. We think that B and C are maybe more likely than the A scenarios. So the difference between B and C, as I said earlier, is really how the transportation-related revenues are used. So I'm going to show you more detailed examples from both of these. But generally, in example B, all of the revenue is turned into either tax reductions or income support. So what happens in those scenarios is if we increase the income of most Oregonians, that's going to turn into consumption. Oregonians tend to consume a lot of things that aren't made in Oregon, right? So that creates economic leakage in our system. So we get small but consistently negative employment impacts and output impacts in those scenarios. When we go to the C scenarios, so we've taken those transportation revenues and we've put them towards the highway trust fund. So they're all turning into basically public works projects around the state. So what ends up happening there is we've cut down on some of that economic leakage. We've kept that economic benefit by using it to fund projects here with Oregon workers. So in those scenarios, we still see very small declines in output, but we tend to see positive economic results. In the D scenarios, again, it depends on what you're using the revenue for, but we tend to see small positive results. There is a negative result that I'll point out on the next slide. And then in scenario E, we barely get away from the baseline in those scenarios. So we created a jobs index, and for all the scenarios we looked at, this is the net number of jobs per $1 million in revenue collected. And we didn't, this shouldn't be interpreted as a tool to sort of evaluate the quality or the goodness of each one of these scenarios. It's just a way of normalizing the results so we can compare them easily. But as we saw in the first one, generally those A scenarios where we have the financial reserves, those are generally negative economic outcomes. The B scenarios, when it's all tax cuts and reductions in taxes and fees, we have small negative results. The results with the highway fund included are small positive. The C630, C660, and C6100, those are our citizen dividend scenarios. So in those, we see a very small, fairly consistent negative outcome. In the D scenarios, I'd like to draw your attention to that D.1.4.1.60. Those numbers make sense if you read the report. That is where we took what were identified by Business Oregon as key industries in Oregon. SB 306 required us to work with Business Oregon to place special emphasis on them. So we wanted to model exempting some industries from the tax to see what would happen, because we know that if the conversation about the carbon tax gets more serious, we know probably every industry in the state will come to you and ask for an exemption. So what we see is when we exempt industries, the exempted industries are fine, right? We've offset the negative impact. But what ends up happening is there's less carbon tax revenue collected. So there's less revenue that can be used to offset the negative impacts in other parts of the economy. So when we introduce exemptions, we actually see negative overall results. The one right next to it, D.1.4.2.60, we take those same industries and we don't exempt them on the front end, but we calculate what their negative employment impact is, and then we set aside revenues and what we're calling an investment fund to target it at those industries to offset those negative employment impacts.
Could you give a for instance of industries that might be exempted?
Yeah. Chair Burdick. In this case, when we ran these scenarios, we just took Business Oregon gave us their list of key industries. So in these scenarios, we exempted advanced manufacturing, high tech, active outdoor gear and activewear, and forestry and wood products. We didn't do clean tech, and I'll explain that in a little bit. But we took those four industry sectors and exempted them. So let's go on to the next one. So we took two scenarios that we'll look at in detail here, and we think that they're representative of a lot of the things that are going on here. So this is employment impacts for different price levels for a scenario in which the transportation revenues are used to offset existing transportation-related taxes and fees, and then the remaining revenues, 70% of them are used to reduce corporate income tax, and 30% are used to reduce personal income tax. So what we see pretty consistently across our revenues is that there's an initial bump in employment. And what we think is happening here is that businesses are reacting to the prospect of consistently higher energy prices. So they're making investments to change their production process in response to this. There's also an effect here where some industries, there is a potential trade-off between labor and capital, basically. So some industries are transitioning their production process into more labor-intensive versions. In this case, after that initial employment bump, the economy comes to sort of a new equilibrium when the price cap is reached. And in this case, all of our scenarios show negative outcomes. But again, as Tom said, these are negative relative to the baseline. We still see positive economic growth here. So this is the same results for the $30 per ton scenario broken out by region. The impacts on regions are really consistent across our scenarios. In almost everything we ran, the Portland metro region is negatively affected. This is due partly to the industry makeup in Portland. I'll talk in a little bit about the types of industries that are negatively affected, but there's a concentration of them in Portland. There's also some economic leakage across the border to Washington that happens in the Portland area that isn't happening nearly as much in the other regions. In all of the other regions, they tend to be very close to the baseline. Whether they're positive or negative depends on the way that we repatriate or we expend the revenues. Output impacts, again, these are pretty similar. We see very small negative output impacts for almost every scenario that we run. In this case, even at $150 a ton, we're, at 0.3%. So generally, the impact on output is pretty minimal. And then for every scenario that we ran in the second appendix, we have a table like this where we break out the top 10 most positively impacted industries and then the bottom 10 most negatively impacted industries for every scenario. And what we see here is the negatively impacted industries, I would tend to split into two groups. So the industries that have a consistently small negative impact tend to be industries like advanced manufacturing, high tech, industries that are very energy intensive, but also industries that have a lot of ability to pass on those higher prices. So in most of the scenarios we run, these industries come out negative, but oftentimes it's double-digit employment losses. It's nothing too big. We consistently see at the bottom of the employment impacts are service industries. So you'll see here there's a collection of healthcare-related industries, and then at the bottom we have food services and drinking places, retail trade, wholesale trade. And really what's happening here is these are the industries that are at the end of the supply chain. So we increase our energy prices. Those are getting passed through the economy. At some point, it gets to the end. It has to go to the consumer. The consumer is going to buy less of whatever good that is. Keep going. As I said, SB 306 required us to work with Business Oregon. They identified industries that they wanted us to pay special attention to. So these are the familiar key industry clusters that Business Oregon works with. Generally, forestry and wood products is either a small positive or a small negative, depending on how the revenue is repatriated. It tends to be outdoor gear and activewear is sort of the same way. And then advanced manufacturing and high tech, we see consistently negative results, but as you can see here, it tends to be very small. Wholesale trade is a piece of all of these industries, but we took it out here because, as you can see, it's pretty consistently negatively impacted. So we didn't want to sort of hide that effect or spread that effect around in all the other industries. So those job losses in wholesale trade would be distributed amongst the other four key industry groups. And then clean tech, it's hard to take anything away from the clean tech results from our report, just because the definition of what clean tech is, it just isn't as developed as what these other industry definitions are. As an example, the official definition of clean tech includes the entire construction sector. It's probably a very small part of the construction sector here in Oregon is operating in a way that we would describe as clean tech. But the definition that we were given, and then basically the way that NAICS codes are generally, it's pretty difficult for us to identify subsets of these sectors that we would describe as clean tech. So we report on clean tech results, but normally what you're actually seeing is the impact of the tax on things like construction and certain types of technical advising. So then this is employment impacts for basically the same scenario as before, except the transportation-related revenues are used for the Highway Trust Fund. So when we use those funds for the Highway Trust Fund, we see consistently positive results. As I said, this is largely due to the fact that this is, in effect, a public works project that is happening all over the state. So a lot of this positive effect is driven by increases in construction jobs in just about every region. Let me show you this broken out by region. So we still have negative employment outcomes in Portland, but they're smaller than they were in the earlier scenarios. And then all of the other industries, Northwest and the Valley, or Northwest and Southwest, are kind of right down on that baseline. But all the other industries experience a positive employment bump due to this increase in construction work in their areas. Output impacts, frankly, they don't look that much different than the earlier scenario, and we don't see very much variation in output impacts across our scenarios. And then this is the same industry impacts chart. The most negatively impacted industries, it's basically the same with a couple of exceptions. And then the magnitudes are roughly the same. The big difference here, obviously, is that the construction industry has received this big stimulus and public funding. So with that, I'll just leave you and say there is so much detail on each one of these scenarios, so I would really encourage you to read the results section, and if that's not enough, there's even more in the appendices. So, thank you.
Thank you for that presentation. Does that conclude your...
Not quite yet.
Okay.
All right, so continuing on, SB 306 also directed us to take a look at a whole list of existing Oregon laws that have potential interactions with the carbon tax to see if these laws potentially overlap or are complementary with the carbon tax. So of the list of Oregon statutes that are already in existence or on the books, we were able to categorize them into three larger categories, being the renewable portfolio standard, motor vehicle emissions regulations that are under the second bullet point here, and then also electric utility-related regulations that have to do with more reporting requirements and siting requirements and standards. So we devoted a very substantial amount of time to investigating these various laws, and there is a lot of detail and analysis in our report, so I would refer you to that particular section of evaluation. But as a high-level summary, we have this chart that kind of summarizes the various purposes of each of these laws. And to kind of sum it up is that all of these regulations have various different objectives and goals and policy objectives that they're trying to reach. And most likely what we've found is that most of these are potentially going to be complementary with the carbon tax, in that most of these do not have greenhouse gas emissions reduction as their primary goal, even though they do cause greenhouse gas emission reductions as kind of a byproduct or as kind of auxiliary result of their policy rules. So what we found was that most of these tend to be complementary with the carbon tax and can potentially cause the same results or add together to further the results of greenhouse gas emissions, but very unlikely that there will be very much overlap in terms of the objectives that they're trying to reach. So in addition, we also talk about various other considerations in our report. So under other considerations, we do take a look at what our potential border tariffs. So when we analyzed our carbon tax, we were looking at putting the carbon tax on combustion here in the state as well as imported electricity. But when during our conversations with the Legislative Council, what we found was that there is indeed ability to put the tax on imported goods that also have some kind of carbon content to reduce the sort of the business competitive effects that a carbon tax would cause here in Oregon. And though theoretically that is definitely a doable idea, practically speaking, we do not currently have data ability or data availability that allow us to figure out accurately what is the carbon content of all the products that we import into the state. So that's one consideration. And then as Drew and Chris have already mentioned, this carbon tax that we're analyzing covers about 83% of all greenhouse gas emissions here in Oregon. So we're only looking at mainly the combustion sources, and there are various other non-combustion sources, say from methane, from landfills, or from agricultural processes that also have emissions but are not covered by this particular analysis. And then there's various impacts on tourism and government that you can find more detail on in our report. And going forward, there are, even though we spent a lot of time and a lot of adding a lot of more detail into our modeling and trying to make sure that everything is accurate, there are obviously still various areas where we would want to do further research into. For example, implementation. We looked at pretty much piggybacking the tax collection mechanism on existing government activities. But if, in fact, a carbon tax is to be implemented, we would definitely suggest looking further into the actual best practices for collection at an agency level, for example. Also, health impacts that are associated with lower combustion of fossil fuels that also reduce byproducts of combustion that can cause positive health impacts. Those things are not included in our report that are also potentially can add to the discussion. So for all of this detail, we can check the further research and application section of our report.
And very quick on concluding comments here. Just if you do have a carbon tax, we think it does have significant emission reductions that can be had, and also it has great revenue potential generation. We've said the economic impacts are small relative to the broader economy, but it's very important to keep in mind that those impacts, although small for the overall economy, do differ both by the region and by income levels and by industry. And it's also possible to offset some of the negative impacts that are associated with a carbon tax. And we sort of sum this up as the tax policy that you create should have the three E's, effective, efficiency, and equitable. It's effective. In this case, it reaches whatever carbon emission reduction goals you have in mind. It's efficient. Do households and businesses are able to reach the particular goal, the impact of the tax, in the least cost way possible? And then equitable, can it be designed to shield low-income households? Can there be targeted investments to help out businesses and households that are affected? And that concludes our study.
Thank you, and I'm very aware this is your third presentation of the day, and really appreciate you getting the word out about this study to not just our committee, but to other committees. The Catlin students brought this up, and I know this goes beyond the scope of the report, but you know, we talk about the carbon tax issue within the context of other policy issues, within the context of other tax systems. But what are your thoughts on how this compares to doing nothing and experiencing the increasing impacts of climate change?
Oh, okay. Chair Burdick, so if we look at the science. There are many reports that have measured the health impacts, impacts on the climate change, the drought situations possible going out to the future. There's a tremendous possibility of very large negative impacts, both at a personal level and a economic business type level. So with doing nothing, I think it sets us to the stage of possibly going to some point of no return, where trying to all of a sudden reverse these climate changes will even be more catastrophic on individuals and households and businesses if it's not addressed sooner than, you know, than later.
So it's fair to say then that given the, and again, I was a little surprised to see the lack of serious economic impact, basically, from this, what could be a fairly major change in policy. So given what we know about the science of climate change, is it a fair thing to say that something like this would have a positive cost-benefit analysis compared to doing nothing in the long run?
Chair Burdick, as you did state, it was not part of our study, but I think the logical extension of this is yes. By being able to do reductions now in this nice controlled way of doing it, designing it so that, you know, we do at least the least harm possible on the economy, provides us with mitigating those other externalities, those costs that are out there. It would put us in, a better position.
Thank you. Questions from the committee. Senator George.
Thank you. Can you go to page 16 on the results overview? I'm not understanding something on the model right here. Okay, so as I understand your modeling here, on your scenarios on the left, it has employment, but what that is that's a siloed captured amount. So you go across, and that's, as I understand it, is an annualized rate. So if you go over to the $100 level, you're at $3.45 billion per year of captured revenue, right? And scenario A is that's just captured and put into a legislative, like, holding fund. Am I correct on that? And so what your modeling says, I want to make sure I understand this, is that if you could take $3.45 million out of the economy and just put it in a lockbox, regardless of whether it's carbon tax or whatever, you take that much out of the economy, total impact per year, I mean, you do that per year over 20 years, so that would be, what are that's, I can't think, I'm trillion, that'd be $7 trillion. The net impact on the state of Oregon would be 37,000 jobs. I'm just making sure I understand the math here, because I don't get that.
Chair Burdick, Senator George. Yeah, so if we were just sort of taking that much value out of the economy, I'm sure that the employment impact would be much larger. I think what's happening here is that, so the economic model is dynamic. So what we're doing is we're using as the first input in the model increases in energy prices. So we have our industries and households reacting to that. So they're changing their changing the way they heat their homes, they're changing the way they transport themselves, industries are changing their production processes, so that the impact of that increase in energy, it probably hurts a lot right in the beginning, which is one of the reasons that we phased in the carbon price over time. But eventually we have the economy adapting itself to a sort of new equilibrium in which energy prices are consistently higher.
I guess I'm trying to get out, and I'll read the report in more detail, but what I'm trying to get my mind around is what the argument is that right now out among businesses there is $3.5 billion of slack, that if businesses would just change what they're doing now voluntarily, the net impact would be a $3.5 billion per annualized return to the businesses if they would just do it right now without government regulation or without any kind of carbon tax, because that's the only way you can kind of justify what's being said here. I get the modeling. I understand what you guys are saying about the rest of the stuff, but I'm wondering about the front up part of it, because it just seems like the modeling assumes you can remove $3.5 billion out of the economy per year and the impact is almost minimal or net nil. That seems like a really strange model.
Well, Senator George, $3.4 billion is a big number, but in the context of the broader Oregon economy compared to Oregon gross state product, it's a small percentage. So that percentage is comparable to the percentage that 37,000 jobs represents. I think Tom said 37,000 is just over a 1% decrease in employment.
That's 37,000 jobs over 20 years. At the end of your career. Or is that per year?
So we would be 37,000.
No, the way the chart read is it was 37,000 at year 20.
Yes, Senator George, that's correct. So it's 37,000 below where we would expect to be without the carbon tax.
In the 20th year, which would be $7 trillion later.
Well, it would be, in this case, with the financial reserve, it would be $7 trillion later over the course of, whenever we reach $100 per ton, which would be 10 years, 12 years in the future.
Okay. I don't disagree with making people pay what they, for unintended consequences. But that modeling just seems to have some kind of flaw in it that I just can't wrap my mind around. So I'll dig into it and figure out what it is.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Senator Rosenbaum.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And thank you all for an incredible amount of work that I know went into this. And we're not going to be able to do justice to the quality of your work or the magnitude of it in this short a time. But I did want to ask you a little more about how you calculated the changes in behavior that would result from a system like this. And I know I see flagged for further research energy efficiency feedback and emissions feedback, but were you looking at the Canadian model or how were you projecting how businesses would reconfigure, how individual households would reconfigure under the system?
Chair Burdick, Senator Rosenbaum. It's a little bit of a technical answer, but it's based on historical data. So within the model, we calculate an elasticity. So an elasticity is just the change in behavior we expect due to a change in price. So the way that the model works is it takes all of this historical data on price levels and various types of economic activity, and then based on changes in each, you come up with an estimate for how various industries and various types of households react to price changes. What's nice about this model is that parameter is dynamic. So we run a scenario. So we go out over time and we're projecting changes in the economy. That parameter is updating itself based on, we're sort of generating new history as we go along. So we can give you ideas about what we think would happen. But a good example of this is when we look at the change in motor fuel demand. In the Portland metro region, we see by far the strongest impact. So what's happening there is people in Portland have more opportunities to switch to public transportation. They have more opportunity, or they don't have more opportunities to switch to lower or more fuel efficient cars, but they have those opportunities on top of the other opportunities you have from living in a densely populated metro area. So the model itself is agnostic about that. It's just saying we think that people are going to react by demanding some quantity less of the fuel they normally demand. And then that's part of our job is to look at those changes and say, okay, we see this change in behavior. Let's look at the research. Let's look at what has happened in other constituencies and see how exactly people have been reacting. So in the report, we talk about when we see those types of changes, we talk about the likely actual changes that are occurring in the economy.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Bertinger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one question to administer this. Did you look into what it would take for the state of Oregon to administer this? In other words, what kind of bureaucracy would we have to start up to administer this?
Chair Burdick, Senator Bertinger.
Good.
Okay. So we did look at some of it, but part of looking at this is that we were envisioning that the tax would be applied at a wholesale level, so similar to gasoline taxes, and also looking at charging it on electricity through at a consumer level, so similar to the public service charge on utilities that are happening. And we took a look at the administrative costs in those particular arenas, and we found that it was very minimal given the amount of work that they were that it seemed like they were doing. So the Energy Trust of Oregon, for example, consistently has administrative costs that are below 4% of their revenue stream. And also the GasTAC administration is also at very low single-digit percentage levels in terms of administrative costs. So we don't actually envision very high costs associated with the tax.
And Senator Birdsugar, if I could add to that, our sort of basic inspiration for this was the British Columbia carbon tax, and I know we've testified before committees down here with the BC Minister of the Environment, and they're very fond of saying that they didn't hire anyone to implement this tax; they just had their people who are already out collecting fees on fuel just do more of what they were doing. So when you read the report, you'll see that we took a lot of care in identifying existing programs or existing agencies that are doing something similar to what would be required from this. And then even when, for example, when we talk about offsetting negative impacts on low-income households, for a really effective way to repatriate some of this revenue into the economy would be to cut personal income taxes or corporate income taxes that wouldn't necessarily benefit low-income households. So we identified existing programs and existing agencies that could have their work expanded to deliver assistance to low-income households.
And if I may also add, Senator, this, I think, when you compare this to another market mechanism approach, the cap and trade, you can set the two up so they're almost exactly equivalent. But one of the bigger differences, I really think, is under this administrative aspect, where it's much more, I think, complicated and so on to have to set up these trading markets for cap and trade. There's just new instruments that have to be provided, whereas with the carbon tax, existing structures, I think, can be more readily used.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. This has been very, very educational and to be continued. We will close the informational hearing on the clean air tax, and I want to thank again the Catlin students and their teacher, Patrick Walsh, for their attention to this issue and your involvement in this issue. And if I were you, I'd leave now, because what we have coming up has nothing to do with climate change.
Thank you.
That might be. Now Thomas is telling me they don't want to introduce, so I'm going to get to the bottom of this.
What is going on?
We got a screw up on a draft. All right. Well, I'm just going to go ahead and do the other hearing. We'll stand in recess for 2 minutes. We'll come back out of recess and reconvene our informational hearing for the Comcast, for an informational hearing on the Comcast Supreme Court decision. What does it mean? And to start us out on that discussion, Kyle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So, yeah, we do have the next segment is related to the Supreme Court decision, and it came out a couple months ago. I put them both. The full decision is up on OLIS. As well as a media release. So the full decision's about 54 pages, where the media release is one page. So you can decide which one to start with.
Mm-hmm.
But So yeah, we have the Department of Revenue will be coming up to discuss the case, what it means, and what's left, or what's being, what is open for further discussion, I guess, with the tax court, as well as some background on central assessment in general. But before that, I wanted to go through just to give a little bit of context of the revenue amounts that we're talking about. So what's up on the screen right now, and this is in OLIS as well, is the total outstanding deferred billing credits through fiscal year 13-14. So the most recent data wasn't available at this time, but these are the bills that just came out in a couple months ago, the recent property tax bills. But what this is, without going too far back, a couple in 2011, House Bill 2569 created the deferred billing credit, and it was a way for essentially assessors in cases of large properties that are being appealed to the courts. It was a way, rather than collecting all the funds and then possibly having to refund it years later all at once with interest, which is 12% interest annually, rather than do that, it's essentially the property taxes are billed, but there's no tax collected. So the property tax owner, in this case Comcast, gets a deferred billing credit. And so this is the full amount that's outstanding right now by county. These are all deferred billing credits, but the vast majority, I mean, you can pretty much take it, 99% of this is related to the Comcast case. And it's hard to see. I guess you can't see the total up on the screen there. But if we scroll down just a bit, you can see each year it's been going up a bit. And if we extrapolate out, include the 14-15 year, we're probably talking in the $105, $110 million range. And that would be, you can kind of think of that as the high bar mark. So if everything's ruled in favor of the Department of Revenue, this is the amount that has been billed and would be the bills that would go out and be due within 45 days of the court's decision. Ultimately, it'll depend upon the court's decision what would be billed, but I think it provides context, at least, for the amount that we're talking about.
And this is money is this money due in 45 days after the Supreme Court case, or does this have to get remanded to a different court and then it starts?
Yes, Chair Burdick, it has been sent back. Some of the decision has been made, so there has been a partial decision, if you will, but there were still some things that need to be clarified, so they sent it back to the tax court. So we still don't know right now. And the intention, I don't believe, is to begin billing for this, because there's still the actual amount that's going to be billed is still up in the air to be decided, if you will.
Okay, so no money has changed hands yet.
Right. Yes.
Okay. All right. Are you done with that? Okay. Let's call up the Department of Revenue and Dimitri from the, or Vince from the governor's office. There you go.
Welcome. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Representative McLean. My name is John Phillips.
Let me introduce. My lack of courtesy is shocking. I want to welcome Representative McLean, who will be sitting in for the rest of this hearing. So my apologies.
Thank you. Okay. And I'm with the Department of Revenue. We're here. We've been asked to speak about the Comcast case and our involvement with that. And the Comcast case, which is issued on October 2nd, as Kyle mentioned, stands for many things. One of the most important things it stands for is the definition of data transmission services. This is a term that the statute uses in defining what a communication company is. And it determined that a data transmission service was any service that provides the means for the transmission of electronically coded information between computers or computer-like devices. So the question of it also introduces new questions. But one of the questions it helped answer was, is video transmission and internet transmission part of communications? And we think it answered that in the affirmative. So we have an outline that we have posted that describes the history of the Comcast decision about centrally assessed properties generally, where they came from. And I can begin at the top of that and work to the current if you'd like, or if you would rather go on with questions, that's fine too.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry to interrupt, but can you tell me what this document is called on OLIS? I'm just not finding it. I'm sure it's here, but
I believe it's called the December 8th Comcast Informational Presentation, Senate Interim Revenue Committee, DOR. It would be submitted by us.
Yeah, it was dated, it's the one with the date, 12/8/14 there.
So under, when you look under meeting material, what, which item is it?
It's the one with the Comcast Center.
Oh, that one. Oh,
okay. Seventh one down.
Okay.
I'm not actually seeing that on the list.
Interim.
So I must be looking in the wrong place. I'm sorry. You don't have to stop the whole hearing for me to find this. But.
Seventh one down.
It's on mine.
It says, yeah, it says Comcast Center interim 12.
Yeah. Okay. Seriously, keep going.
Okay. I would like you to kind of flesh out this a little bit. This is a really complicated case, and I think it would be useful to just kind of work Absolutely. Your way down. And
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. And just I will just say that central assessment was in Oregon and the rest of the United States was created or engendered or began before the turn of the century, the previous one. And so it's been around over 100 years, and it was all about accuracy and consistency, and this had to do with companies that were like public utilities, where they were a networked organization, and they had possibly a cross-state line type networks and systems. And so it was very difficult for a county or a single state to value, like, say, a mile of railroad ties and rail, when it's really looking at Burlington Northern, for example, which is an integrated company, and you'd have to figure out what the contribution of that rail or that tie was to the overall operating unit. So most states adopted something called central assessment. And in Oregon, we still have that today. It's changed slightly over the years and century. But what it does is it gives the opportunity to value an operating unit and then take just the portion that applies to the state of Oregon in particular, and then assess a value based on the contribution in that state. The key and significant difference of being centrally assessed in Oregon versus being locally assessed is the assessment of intangible property. All other properties are assessed on their personal property, their machinery and equipment, their land value, their buildings. But centrally assessed property, like electric companies, transportation companies, communication companies, are assessed on their total company value. And that is why there is often disagreement about this area of the law. And we're supposed to, as the Department of Revenue, administer that and centrally appraise every one of these companies every year. And that's what we've been doing. There's been a kind of an evolvement of the definition of communications over the years. And there were some changes in 73, including this new term. And communications companies have been evolving as technology has come, unlike any of the other fields. And so we have companies that not only have a single type of evolving technology, but they have blended models of complications. So we are charged with that, trying to figure out whether a company is a communications company or not. And companies that weren't at one time perhaps are now. And that's exactly what the court found in this particular case. Why weren't we centrally assessing them years ago? And the court found, well, they haven't always been. We don't know when they became a communications company, but we know they are today. And that's what the court said. We saw this coming probably just behind the curve, but in 2006 we saw this coming. Other companies that were competing in the same vein, in the same use of property, with kind of head-to-head with other companies, some were being taxed centrally assessed and some were not. And one of these companies was the companies in the cable industry, and we said we need to do something about this, not because we're setting policy, but because we think they fall under the definition of communication and they are competing. They're also an operating network of systems, just like the statute calls for. And so we told this body in 2006 at this table that we were going to be assessing Comcast and cable companies and internet service providers by 2008 or 2009 if we didn't hear anything from you. And so in 2007 passed, 2009 passed with no legislation. We started assessing Comcast and related companies in 2009.
Okay, can you fill us in on the companies that were not centrally assessed before that became centrally assessed because of this policy change? We know that Comcast was one of them, and I think satellite companies became in that category as well.
Yes, Madam Chair.
And what are some of the other ones that started being assessed that way?
I believe to that you would add internet service providers, and beyond that, I can't think of a fourth one off the top of my head. But generally, it was cable companies, internet service providers, and satellite companies. Yeah. Right. So that led to the lawsuit that became the Comcast case. We, the Department of Revenue, lost at the tax court. Comcast offered an opinion of the statute, what it meant. We offered an opinion of what we thought it meant, and the court found a completely different conclusion. So, as you can see, it's extremely obvious. And I'm being funny there. Trying to be. So it's a complicated matter, and we're trying to solve this. So, anyway, the court found that we appealed the case, and the Supreme Court ruled in our favor. And so what we hope is that what can come out of this is a good discussion about where do we go from here as a state, and how can we bring more certainty to the central assessment area. It's no fun for any of us litigating this, and it certainly doesn't provide any clarity for business making decisions. So,
one of the things that has come to my attention is that a number of states seem to be moving away from taxing intangibles. It's always been a sticking point. I've been hearing about it ever since I was elected in 1996, but it seems to be less of a flashpoint with the utilities and that type of industry than it does with these communication companies. Can you tell us where it seems to be heading nationally and how you see that trend going?
Right. Madam Chair, I guess I would answer that by saying I think we're pretty much an island in the Western states and the nation generally in terms of taxing intangibles. I think most states have been moving away from that model. We have a little bit of a complication. And most states have had a complication with extracting intangibles from the central assessment valuation process. Because when you value a home, let's say a residential value, the land maybe, you'll see the improvements. But with a centrally assessed company, we're appraising the company as a whole. And we aren't saying, oh, the intangibles are 15% or this many dollars. So we don't discreetly value intangibles. So if you were to create, let's say, an intangible exemption, for tax administration, we wouldn't know what to take out because we don't appraise it. It's very difficult to appraise an intangible
If you don't appraise it, how do you tax it?
Well, it's a secret that we have. No, actually, I'm sorry, but actually we value the whole company. And so what's left over from adding up, presumably, please jump in.
Your name for the record.
For the record, my name is Mike Vaughn. I'm the valuation manager for the Oregon Department of Revenue. I'm responsible for the central assessment program as well as the industrial program. I think what John is talking about and attempting to articulate is that we appraise the entire company. And oftentimes, as you're appraising, I'm sorry, can you hear me?
We're fine.
No, first time I've been in front of the committee, so it's a bit of a moment for me. we value the entire company. And typically when you do that, you're looking at all of its assets. So you're looking at income, if you're familiar with appraisal, you're trying to project out that income, company's income, out into a particular time frame and then discounting that back to a present value. Now, oftentimes when you're talking about intangible versus tangible value, companies of the magnitude we're discussing here today are in the billions of dollars worth of value. And so trying to articulate through an appraisal what might be that component attributable to just the intangible part is a challenge. And it's an incredible challenge if you talk about the time frame that we have to value all of the companies that we're charged with valuing in the time frame we have statutorily. So it's not that it's impossible or it's really hard. It's just it's one of the challenges that we face, and I think John is trying to articulate that it would be a challenge on a go-forward basis.
Well, then my question becomes, if the other states that are moving away from intangibles, how do they do it?
Okay. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, that's a good question. Right now, the latest research we've done for what the other states do is it dates back to 2006. Currently, we're in the process of updating that information so that we can answer that question better. But I can tell you from the research that we have going back to 2006, there's a range. Some apply a formula, so that would be, all intangibles or some ratio to the overall value, 20%, 30%. Some don't provide that level of guidance, and it's up to the individual appraisers responsible for valuing these companies to articulate what that might be, and certainly everything in between.
And if I can elaborate, Madam Chair, one of the complexities that we have here is not only in how we do it, but it's the results of what we do. Many other states don't have what's known as Measure 50, and to the extent that we have Measure 50, when we remove value from the roll, we create a situation where there's a net loss. In other states, or pre-Measure 50 here, if we had a tax exemption of any kind, that would essentially increase the tax rate and everybody else would pay a little bit more money. So the challenge for Oregon is, first of all, how are we going to do it that doesn't eventually create additional litigation? And secondly, what are we going to do, if anything, with the revenue impact?
Right. I think you just put your finger on it. Yeah. You have a question?
Yeah.
Okay. Quick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How do you value a company that's spread over several states? Do you say, well, they do 13% of their business in Oregon, and is that how you do it? Or?
Yeah. Chair Burdick, Senator Bertschager?
They're getting it. They're starting to get it.
Is that the last time I have to pronounce that? That's a challenging question. Without getting too in depth into the appraisal theory, there are three approaches to value. This would be applied to a building as similar to a company. But basically what we do is we look at applying those three approaches to value to every company we appraise. And generally, we value the entire company. So whether it's nationwide, globally, we develop a value based on the sales or market approach may be looking at stock and debt allocators. For the income approach, we might be looking at what their company earns and the expenses they have and projecting that out over a life and discounting it back. Cost may be looking at the historical costs of the company and coming up with a value less the depreciation. And once we do that, then we have formulas that are defined in statute that help us allocate back to Oregon. So there are ratios that we then apply, come up with a value for Oregon, and then we look to apportion that value to the varying tax and district based on how we're required to do that. Does that get to the...
I can see why we get tied up in court.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's a lot of opinion generated through this process, and that's...
I think the real rub is the intangibles, because the apportionment is very well established for income taxation. The formula is pretty straightforward.
Correct.
Okay, other questions from the committee? We kind of blew up your presentation. Did you get everything in that you need?
Perfectly fine.
Okay, so I'll turn it over to Vince.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. My name is Vince Porter. I'm the Governor's Economy and Jobs Policy Advisor. I just wanted to take a few minutes to comment, not necessarily on the case, although I would encourage to go for the full 54 pages instead of the one pager, because there's some rather amazing things that are spelled out in there. And the one that stands out the most for me is that we are looking at communication companies based on a law that was written in 1973. They talk about, I think, the future in 1973 relating to communication companies was a phone and a possible microwave network. Today, we're dealing with data centers that we would have never even comprehended that are currently in a current proposed rule that are going to fall into central assessment. We're dealing with satellite companies that also provide wireless. So we are trying to interpret, and I am sympathetic to Department of Revenue and Department of Justice to come up with how to make sense of what we wrote in 1973 for today and the next decade. And I would just, you know, wanted to highlight that because I think when we are working with these companies that are certainly at risk, whether they're making mobile devices and data centers or search engines, or I won't name any of them, but you could probably guess who I'm talking about. They want certainty and they want to understand how we are interpreting the laws, and they're looking at other states. And as John appropriately said, we are an island on this one right here. And I know that it's not easy for us to find a solution because of the potential impact, but it is important to me, and I think important to the governor, that we really take a serious look at the statute, and see if there's a way forward where we can have a modern law on communications and data transmission services, because without it, we will not have the kind of infrastructure relating to this industry that will affect all companies, whether it's manufacturing. I think agriculture is impacted, and certainly communications. So I would just encourage us, and we're eager to work with you. I know a couple years ago there was an attempt, and everyone said, well, let's just wait till the Comcast decision mm-hmm. is done. Well, we're here now. But one thing, if we don't, I think there's three things that we're going to be facing moving forward if we don't. I don't think this will be the last Supreme Court decision on this issue. I think that there are plenty of other companies that are very concerned and about clarity about how to move forward. I think we'll also lag behind from other states. We're currently, and I can appreciate Representative McClain being here, we're currently facing potential loss of investment upwards of $1 billion on at least three projects that are waiting for some more clarity. And then the other thing is that we will be faced with the immediate and try and put Band-Aids on these. I think, you know, there's some that would say that the Facebook law was a noble attempt, but it might have opened up some continued uncertainty on how we're moving forward. So I just wanted to come and, you know, first appreciate, not apologize, that where Department of Revenue is on this and Department of Justice and their advice. But encourage and offer our assistance to work forward on this issue so that we continue to get the kind of investment that we want throughout the state.
Thank you. And as I've learned more about this issue, I think you put your finger on it when you said we need fairness, we need certainty, and I would add to that we need a level playing field. This is a highly competitive business, and I think it's really important to have everybody playing from the same playbook, which is not the case right now.
Chair Burdick, if I may just say something about that. I think, you know, ironically, the laws, I think, might even prevent us from having additional competition in the state in this field. While this decision is about Comcast, I think it's also about all the potential competitors that might be interested in coming into our state to compete with Comcast. And as they look at these laws and make their decisions, I think this issue in particular will be front and center.
Yeah, I think our time's up on this one. All right, anything to add? Any questions from the committee? Representative McClain.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for allowing me to be here. Mr. Porter, is it a fair characterization that out of the $1 billion of potential loss, economic development, a significant, if not majority, of that is in Prineville, Oregon?
Chair Burdick, Representative McClain, I would say it's fair to say that a significant amount, and I would say it includes also the coast and some of our metro regions.
Thank you. And, Madam Chair, I just want to emphasize that, you know, Crook County just had, we lost our third largest employer, Milgrain. Is leaving Prineville. That's 230 jobs. We are the most unemployed county. We've been that way for 5 years. 2 years ago, you saved Prineville by your work to help with the Facebook bill, but we're facing a crisis. And these are great jobs. Prineville is just an acute example. but we got to have a decision real quick because my concern is that the speed of this assembly doesn't match the speed of the industry, and they are already looking for alternative locations. If centralized assessment is as complex as I perceive, then the easiest way to do it is get rid of it and really talk about alternative ways to replace that don't leave an industry. I mean, I don't want to put you out of a job, sir, but it sounds like you're a very qualified individual who's got ample opportunities. But
we're getting a little ahead of ourselves on this. But, we're still in the information gathering.
Well, good. But my hope is the governor's office is continuing to engage between now and January, which is already fast approaching for deadlines.
Chair Burdick and Representative McLean, we will remain engaged, and we'll continue to talk with those that you're referring to. And I do want to – we're not talking about doing away necessarily with central assessment. I don't want to go that far, make that kind of suggestion. But I think looking at the how central assessment for communications companies in particular would be our focus.
Yeah, and I think that's enough of a bite to bite off here on that. Question. Do you have a question?
I just have a question about where the case. So the case was remanded, but is it also on appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Madam Chair,
I don't really
Senator
understand
Rosenbaum.
How that works. When a case is remanded, can the loser also appeal the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court?
I actually am not in a position to answer that. I can tell you that part of the case that was remanded to the tax court is the part that deals with what the taxable value is.
Mm-hmm.
But the federal issues, I believe the Supreme Court declined to reconsider the opinion when mm-hmm. asked to reconsider.
The state Supreme Court.
Yes, the state Supreme Court declined to reconsider and rule on those issues. So where they go from there, I think that would be a question for an attorney.
I don't think the
So we don't have the lawyers that argued these cases here, no. then?
Actually, we do. Our attorney is here.
Ah.
If you'd like an answer.
Well, just bring it up quickly to answer that question. It's just a yes or no question.
Well. Madam Chair and Senator Rosenbaum, the...
Your name, please.
Oh, Marilyn Harbor, attorney with Department of Justice, and yes, I argued the case. The issue regarding Measure 50 is the only issue that was remanded to the tax court. But as far as I'm aware, there has been no other petition for review in the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's only going to the tax court.
Thank you.
Well, and follow up, I mean, the state wouldn't be asking the Supreme Court to review it because the state won. So it would be Comcast that would be appealing.
We
it,
have
right?
them come.
And they're about to tell us what they're doing. Okay.
but we don't know when they're going to be here.
Okay, our next witness is from the industry, Mr. Dewey, representing the cable industry as well as Comcast.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Mike Dewey on behalf of the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. And Comcast is a member of our association. So I've been involved in following this since 1973. As some of you know, I was in the room on the Senate and House side when I started representing the cable industry in 75. Actually, an agricultural client had another issue about central assessment because it was more than just data transmission by whatever means. We went as far as in developing the litigation, we went as far as getting a forensic specialist, audio specialist, to figure out what the committee was saying because the audio wasn't very good. And we got most of it, and it was part of the transcript. And we have Senator Atiyah, who was in the Senate at the time, asking questions about this and how narrow it might be or broad. And we had Senator Bill Hoyt, a longtime member of the legislature, that also spoke. And the record was pretty slim on the House side because it really was not controversial.
in the sense that Mr. Phillips talked about this, it was somewhat of a narrow solution getting it this new thing called microwave transmission and mainly data back and forth for banking interest and bringing it under central assessment. And remember, for the communications industry, central assessment means two things. One is you are appraised, the value is set by the Department of Revenue, not the local assessor, number one. And that's not an issue, at least for our client. Others may have an issue about that in terms of the industry. But number two, intangibles come into play, and that's the elephant in the room. So this was a pretty narrow fix, but unfortunately, the legislature added the words after describing data transmission by whatever means. And that got us into the pickle we are in. Mr. Canary is here, and he's been involved in the Comcast case. He's an attorney in Portland. And if you want to get into some legal discussions, we can, about where the case is going. I'll answer that in a few minutes. But if he needs to amplify that a little bit and add more, we'll do that. So we actually had a case in the late 1980s that Mr. Canary, it was the Jones Internet cable case in Douglas County, which was really the first central assessment case that we saw. And fortunately, the cable industry won at the Oregon Tax Court, and that was not appealed. But the technology has changed, and the facts have changed since 1988 or 1989. We actually had legislation passed twice. Governor Kitzhaber, and this is kind of ironic because we really appreciate the testimony from the governor's office, Mr. Porter, and it was very good, and I could almost rest my case right there, trying to find a solution, because this is really about a dialogue today. We had legislation twice vetoed in Kitzhaber 1 that would have fixed this to a large degree. But again, the technology has changed, and the people in the room are different. The Department of Revenue actually in the counties brought legislation to centrally assess cable companies in the 90s. That failed. And then, of course, there was the discussion starting in 2006 to bring cable companies in and later satellite companies and others. So I want to give a fair and balanced view here because the day before Thanksgiving, and I'm serious about that because I'm speaking for the industry. So I want to be very, very fair here and not make this cable centric. So the day before Thanksgiving, the Department of Revenue, and they're trying to expedite a rule, an administrative rule, that is literally, other than examples, one sentence that speaks to what is a communication company for central assessment. And we think the rule doesn't add clarity or certainty by any means. We recognize it's very, very hard to write the rule, and that's why we think the legislature should take the time with all the experts, including the Department of Justice, the industry, the Department of Revenue, counties and cities, school districts, and the like, and you'll understand why they would care in just a second. So we had a meeting, I think it was their advisory committee, they called it, the day before Thanksgiving, and their conference room was not going to help with the capacity, so we went over to the Department of Labor and Industries on the second floor, and it's a big, big conference room, and there were a lot of people from out of state. You had Amazon's, Microsoft, Yahoo, Google's of the world. I could go on and on and on. The governor's office was there, cable companies, the League of Oregon Cities, the counties. So all of the parties were there to discuss the rule. So you can see it's a huge, huge issue. And for many companies, they're just not sure if they're in or out. And one reason the department wanted to expedite this rule is to be able to notify as soon as possible, because the rule, I understand, would be effective January 1, the new companies that would come under central assessment. So they're not surprised, but some may be surprised. Now, what, of course, gets us to the problem is the data transmission by whatever means and intangibles.
And just so we get a sense of what those are, and they are in the statute, Goodwill, patents, workforce, contracts, those are all of parts of what would make up the operating unit of a company. And Goodwill, at least for cable companies, a franchise would be a significant value, notwithstanding that we compete with others that would not need a franchise based on their business model. So what we're looking for is clarity and certainty. I want to give you some examples of why this is important to the cable industry and others. I'll just give you the video side. And you are all technological savvy, right?
You're right.
Yeah, I look at you and I know that. So we're in the video business, and it's an interesting business. We're in the broadband business. Internet access, telephony, video, but I'll just take video. So over the top is when someone else uses your network to basically develop or use their content, and they don't need a cable customer anymore. And companies are smart to do that using our network. So Netflix would be an example. And in the evening, and almost every evening, for a cable system or a telephone company that has a their broadband internet service delivering video over it, 35% of the capacity of the broadband network is Netflix. And that's why we have this debate about net neutrality, and I'm not going to get into that here today. But you've got Apple TV, you've got Google TV, you've got Amazon, so we're all competing with each other over different technological facilities. So the world has changed. So for companies, many, many companies, the tax bill will increase by, and for you that were looking to raise revenue, you'll maybe be surprised. Because of intangibles, local property taxes, 300 to 400%. That's why Representative McLean, when we had the discussion about Facebook and the data centers and enterprise zones, that's why they wanted some certainty, at least for the period of the enterprise zone, that they would not be centrally assessed, because it is a huge, huge tax bill. And the issue is whether or not data centers, and Oregon is a good place, based on the latest study, to locate a data center for a variety of reasons. So that's why, in many ways, we have to fix this, because enterprise zones will stop at some point in time. So let me just give you cable for the example. I'm not privy to the other numbers. So we'll take Comcast, because that's the case. 3% of, in Oregon, Comcast total footprint, 3% of their customers are in Oregon, 3%. 11% of their property tax bill comes from Oregon. So that's the 3.94%.
Is that before or after the court decision?
It's actually before and after, because we were in central assessment. Now, what's going to happen, and I'll get back to what's remanded here in a second, the issue is, in many cases, and you passed a bill, I think it's an 11, to allow the county some discretion in terms of not taking all of the dollars that are in dispute, because if Comcast had prevailed, and they still may prevail, and I'll get into the remand, the interest is 12% per annum. So Comcast and other cable companies, I don't know about satellite, have paid the bills, or they've asked not to have them pay the entire bill, so they're not subject to the 12%. But I don't know where that is, and each county would do that. Another way of looking at this in terms of the real value of property taxes, just in terms of the customer's bill, on average, from property taxes across the United States for Comcast, it's $15 per year, property taxes. In Oregon, it's $52.53 per year. So it's, again, 4-plus times. So that's why this is such a significant issue. in terms of chilling investments, the communication sector, from what I understand, is continuing to make the largest investments in infrastructure in the United States, much bigger in the auto industry, for example. And the auto industry, they've got to land somewhere. A communications company infrastructure can almost be anywhere unless you're to the last mile. Your data center could be anywhere. Your servers can be anywhere. You can be anywhere in the cloud. From what we understand in the research we've done, Arkansas, and this is trying to get apples to apples, is the only state that does what Oregon does. Now, there's a lot of money at stake here, and there are ways to fix it, and I know the counties and cities and school districts and others want to be involved in that discussion. We appreciate very much having this conversation, the governor's office wanting to try and fix it, because this industry will continue to thrive. There's no question about that. It will change, and there are going to be winners and losers, but it ought not to be on property taxes. I mean, that ought not to be the basis for people making investments or deciding not to come to Oregon. So there are a lot of ways to fix this. I mean, you can phase out over time intangibles. And I'm just throwing out ideas. Some people are going to say that's a bad idea. You could have a proxy for a period of time for intangibles. So there are ways to do this. And you need to do it that way because you're always going to have the conundrum of what is a communication company in terms of the statute, because you can never catch up with the technology. That's why Congresswoman Walden wants to rewrite the 1996 Telecom Act, because it's broken, because it doesn't work anymore in terms of what the definitions are. So what's been remanded, the big issue remanded back to the tax court, is under Measure 50, if you reclassify a property, in other words, from the local assessor to the state of Oregon under the Department of Revenue, and you start taking intangibles into consideration under central assessment, how does the 3% apply? And we all know kind of on our residential bills, there is that limitation. So that has been remanded back, plus, I believe, three other questions. Now, it's my understanding with regard to an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, these are federal questions. Others are federal questions that have not been looked at by the Oregon Supreme Court because they didn't need to get there. They already got their opinion, so they didn't need to go any further. So those need to be litigated. But I suggest that we ought not wait. And the other part of this is that for all the companies that are under central assessment, most of them are going to be in the tax court on value. And that will be a very precise trial, very technical trial with experts on both sides about the value. And what we heard is, and we understand this, this is very imprecise. And with intangibles, you do get a lot of litigation, notwithstanding who's in or out, just in terms of the value. So you've got both, who's in and out, question, and then you're going to have issues about value. So we appreciate the opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
It's going to be a fun session. Questions from the committee?
I'll reserve the right to ask them later.
Okay. Nope, now or never. All right, thank you very much.
Oh, I was going to say one more thing. And I do appreciate this issue. I was the past president of the Salem Chamber of Commerce. There are a lot of people from out of town that came in and can't get flights until tomorrow, so I hope they stay in Salem. So
thank you. Thank you for that shameless plug.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that concludes this part of it. So we will close the informational hearing on the Comcast decision and open up a informational hearing on options for addressing falling take-home pay.
That cleared the room.
It cleared the room.
No one's interested in following take-home pay?
No. Probably even less interested in my reserve presentation.
That's all right. We'll just wait. Okay, we're proceeding here. So Vince Porter, would you like to come back? Paul.
No one stuck around for this one.
Madam Chair and member of the committee, we have been working with the governor's office with an issue that has actually we've visited extensively in this committee back in the 90s, but haven't looked at it really closely for quite a while. And that's the issue of what happens to overall take-home pay as income rises. So the governor's budget has a proposal in there, and Vince is here to describe that.
Okay, thank you. Chair Burdick, Senator Rosenbaum. My name is Vince Porter. I'm the governor's economy and jobs policy advisor. We did want to just take a real quick note, since we have both in the governor's budget an item and then also a legislative concept which calls for a task force on this particular issue, just to fill you in on some of the work we've been doing with Paul relating to something that has struck the governor and as a problem that we need to fix. And that, as you see in this chart here, we currently have a system, if you look at both the income and the tax credits and the benefits, we currently have a system where people on our lower end of the wage scale are actually coming home with either not as proportionally amount increased amount of money in their pocket, and in some cases, as they move up the wage scale, actually a decrease in the amount of money that comes with them. And that largely has to do with that the change of the benefits fall off at such a rapid rate that what they can earn as they make more money can't make up the difference. So as we were looking through the tax credits that you'll be looking at, and we did recommend two credits to be extended that sort of address some of these issues, both the working family tax credit and the IDA credit, we wanted to put forth a concept that really addresses sort of the smoothing out of this benefit cliff so that, as the governor likes to say, that we are making work pay. And the proposal that we've worked with Paul on is still very much a concept, and very much there's room to work with the legislature on. But the one that we've suggested to consider is to take those who qualify for the working families credit, allow them to then get an additional 5% credit on their adjusted gross income. That takes them up through all the way up into to when they make $17.10 an hour, but sort of smooth out that so that it starts to decline. I believe the number and the declining is around $13 or $14, Paul. Is that right?
Yes.
But what that would do is it would actually provide an addition, provide sort of a proper proportional income as they make more money. Paul is so much better at going through the numbers and the charts than I am. I'm going to let him take it on from here. But like I said, we have a task force. We have $21 million. We have a task force bill, and we have $21 million in the governor's budget to look at this. And also just want to make note that we acknowledge that this could be one tool of several that we could look at to address this issue.
Madam Chair, just a couple of details on the charts, and as Vince said, this is a work in progress. But the examples we've looked at, I emphasize their examples, and so we focused on three benefits: the TANF benefit, which doesn't even appear on this chart because it goes away at such a low income level; the SNAP, Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, food stamps. And the other big one is child care, employee-related child care. So you do have a combination of tax policies that lead to refundable credits, the earned income credit and the mm-hmm. working family credit. So both of those, most of the folks in this category actually have a negative income tax. So we build that into their net income. Of course, that gets smaller, too, as their income rises and they get less of the refundable credits. But what you can see is the effect as you go up this income ranges, and we in general begin to see this negative net income in the 1110 to 1310 per hour basis. And again, we're making specific assumptions of one adult family of three. We're assuming they work full time at these wage levels for 40 hours a week. So there's going to be a lot of variation around those kind of assumptions. The slide, when we get to looking at the credit itself that we've been working with, the idea about the working family credit is that it's a marker or an eligibility requirement. We're not, as you recall, the working family credit is based on daycare expenses, and you get a portion of those expenses refunded. But this would just be that if you get the working family credit, then you can also get this additional credit, which wouldn't be specifically related to daycare. So it would be a percent of AGI, and that's something you would want to talk about. Is there other some modification to AGI you may want to make? You have to set a cap, because you go up to that cap, and then just like the earned income credit, you recall, has a kind of pyramid structure. You go up, you plateau, and then you start to go down. You'd have a similar credit here that begins to be phased out. In our example here, it starts to phase out at 15, 10, 16, 10, 17, 10. Each of those red bars are proportionally a little smaller as you move up the income spectrum. All those would be policy levers you could work with in terms of how you'd want to actually implement that credit. But the idea would be to try to get at that valley that's created when those benefits go away and take-home pay actually turns negative at the margin.
Questions from the committee?
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. And I have to say, I find it really discouraging that the room empties out like this once we're through with something that affects a few large companies, but then we're talking about something that affects literally hundreds of thousands of hardworking Oregonians, and nobody seems to be around except for a few hearty souls to talk about it. So. Yeah, and some of them do work at those companies. But I guess when I first heard about this, I was just kind of confused about what was going on, because I know that there are a lot of different ways you could go about trying to do something in terms of equity for the same population of people. And so there's been a lot of work done in this committee, and we actually did expand the earned income credit last session. So it sounds like this proposal is basically taking the population that qualifies for working family child care credit, and then whatever they're eligible for, they would get an additional 5% up to this cap?
They would get 5% of their adjusted gross income.
Oh, of their income?
Yes. So we're looking at a cap here of about we've been working with monthly data, so we'd be looking at a cap of about $1,200 annually. And, of course, that's one of the trade-offs that you have to make is if you concentrate this more, of course, you can make it more worthwhile for that group you're trying to aim it at. If you spread it out very widely, then of course, it becomes a much smaller amount or a much bigger revenue impact. So that was the discussion was around it. And we looked at a revenue impact of around $20 million, which the governor's built into his budget, but that's annually. So even with this particular proposal, it would be around $20 million per year, 40 per biennium.
And Chair Burdick, Senator Rosenbaum, your point about their income is a good point. And I think it's something we have to sort of figure out is if I remember right, raising the earned income credit another 2% would be about $13, $14 million. So it's almost a good comparison. While it would have a much larger impact on a lot more people, I think well over 200,000, the amount you're talking about is about a fifth of what we're suggesting here in this credit per person, per family or per person. So figuring out what the right measure of having the impact that genuinely provides an incentive to make more money in an hourly wage, I think is what we are really focused on. And however, the best way to achieve that, whether it's a combination of this and the earned income credit, we're eager to have that conversation.
And just to follow up, Madam Chair, this work group that you referred to is an ongoing work group. I just wasn't aware of this work.
Most of our work's been with Mr. Warner here, or Dr. Warner.
He is a work group in his own.
but we're coming into the session, we're certainly eager to work with more people on it.
And I would add, too, we've had a little bit of discussion with Department of Revenue, but obviously the implementation and issues would be, we wouldn't want to talk with them about suggestions and how that might be implemented effectively.
And with working, just final follow-up, with working family send setting, then obviously that credit itself has to prove itself. And then it sounds like this discussion is kind of piggybacking on top of that, right? I mean, I just would, as a final comment, say that simplicity of these kinds of credits are really important, because you don't want people who don't have a lot of extra money to hire accountants to have to deal with a complex system and maybe not know what they're eligible for and fail to get something that they're entitled to. So that's one of the things that we've always worked hard to try to do, is make sure, I mean, it seems like one of the things that would be great is if these kinds of credits were automatic, so that you didn't actually have to do anything. It was just, but you do, because if you don't make enough to owe taxes, you have to fill out a form, so you have to know you're eligible, and that creates this whole need for outreach and all that. So,
well, the assumption here is that this would be refundable, so you would have that element to it. Advantage of going as a percent of AGI, you wouldn't, for example, comparing it to the current working family credit, you've got to have the records to indicate where those expenses are, and so that's potentially auditable to show that with those records. This would be, you'd basically have your AGI, which would be calculated as part of your return, and then the percentage would just be applied to that if you're eligible.
But you wouldn't, I guess maybe I'm misunderstanding. I thought you were saying you first had to qualify for the child care credit.
Qualify for the, yes, you do. So you'd still
have
that.
So that would be the gate.
You'd still have that gatekeeper would be the same. Yeah. But this additionally would flow automatically if you're eligible, because it's just based on AGI. Hmm.
You're still going to have somebody prepare the taxes.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad you took it on. It's very hard. It's a very hard thing, because if you make it too easy, then the fraud happens. And so it's really a very difficult thing. I remember when I looked over the Department of Revenue enforcement records one time, and there were page after page after page of earned income tax frauds that they caught, you know. And so we just want to make sure that every single dollar that's aimed at one of these working families gets there and not to people who are trying to exploit the system. And hopefully the new computer system will help with that.
That's an excellent point.
All right. Anything to add, Vince?
That's all from me.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close that hearing, and what else do we have here?
Madam Chair, we have one more issue, which is the reserve fund.
That's right.
And that's the last item in your packet, reserve fund policy. And I've tried to come up with better titles, Lessons from the Great Recession. So make the reader want to read on. But this was actually grew out of a discussion I had with the chair. And a report that came out from the Pew Research Institute recommending some approaches for states to pursue in terms of developing their reserve fund policy in light of what we experienced in the Great Recession, which actually was 07 to 09, but of course we've had the lingering effects really ever since. Just to remind you of kind of where the revenue situation, what I'm going to try to do here is focus on the forecast itself and the accuracy of the forecast, the deviation of the forecast. I think that Mark and Josh from Office of Economic Analysis have done a good job explaining to you the fundamentals of what causes the volatility in our economy. And, of course, we know about the income tax itself. But if you look historically over the general fund, you can see the two sharp downturns we experienced in the 2000s. You can also see the forecast that is you're currently working with calls for basically trend level growth. You do tend to see that. I mean, that's pretty standard for most forecasts when you look out in the out years. But just to throw a damper on things is to remind you that the business cycle is still very much in play. And if you actually start to look at when this recession ended, in 2009, the length of the period since the end, or the length of the expansion, is actually longer than the post-war average already. So if you're thinking about out through the 15-17 biennium or the next biennium, you're talking about an expansion that's starting to push historical, historically longest cycles expansions we've had, the one in the 60s. And the one in the 90s that began in 1991 is the longest in U.S. history, or at 120 months. So of course, just because there's time for a recession doesn't mean we'll have one, but we are creeping up on averages. If you look at kind of what we've seen in terms of the forecast record, and if you look at the next slide, Chris, on the forecast record, you can see that there's the margin of error, the dollar errors you've seen, and again, you can see the magnitude in the early 2000s where large swings, particularly the two down cycles or two down biennium caused by the Great Recession, and then the 01-03, which is very heavily concentrated in a single biennium, where we saw the bigger decreases than we've ever seen historically. And that really includes percentage-wise here, too, is we're dealing with a bigger general fund now, but the percentage decline was 15%, for example, in 01-03. That was the error compared to the baseline forecast.
I thought it was 20.
Madam Chair, it can depend on how you measure this. I haven't made any adjustment for policy enacted. If you pull out the revenue that you added through decisions in those special sessions, it would be about 20%. Okay. But I've just left that. This is just a raw number comparing what we actually got, including your actions, compared to what was forecasted at the close of session. So you can see you've gotten into this 10 to 15% range with these recessions in recent years. You also see the 11-13, how close it is, and so far 13-15 is also extremely close. So you've had a couple of biennia where the forecasters have been on the money. But we've got two major sources that have really generated the volatility in the system, and it's pretty obvious which ones they are. I mean, this is, Senator Hass always comes up with a name for these. I would call this the Grand Canyon revenue sources is capital gains, and that's the black lines. And you can see when the general fund went down, it was the capital gains that drove it down, and again in the Great Recession. So, and a corporate has been equally volatile in terms of percentage changes. So what I did was I went back and looked at the forecast deviation by component. So where can you put the greatest reliability in terms of these estimates? General fund overall, the standard deviation is 7.2%. Okay, so if you think about your statistics, within one standard deviation, about two-thirds of the time, you're within that one standard deviation for a normal distribution. Two standard deviations, which would be double this, 14% for the general fund, you're within that about 95% of the time. Now, look what happens with the standard deviation when you look at these different components. The non-corporate general fund, i.e. the kicker base, is about 6.1%. That's what Mark's been talking about as he talks about as you get close to that kicker threshold, 6.1%, that's predominantly income taxes, but all of the general fund. Corporate itself has actually gone down a little bit. It was in the 30%, and now it's about 30% through the 11-13 standard deviation. Capital gains, I constructed a series for capital gains because we didn't have a formal forecast for it and still really don't. I just based it on the capital gains in the prior biennium and assumed that it grew at the same rate as the projection for non-corporate general fund, which is basically what we did. Of course, in my day, in which we used to gaze at the stars and look at the animal entrails to figure out what the forecast was, and they're much more sophisticated now. But still, the capital gains one is virtually impossible to project, and you're right, again, in a period of a lot of uncertainty. If you pull out capital gains from the general fund, the standard deviation drops about 1.5%, so from 7.2 to 5.7. If you pull it out of the non-corporate general fund, it goes from 6.1 down to 4.5. So that's your kicker base. So you've got, you knock off about 1.5% of error there. And again, in terms of dollar amounts, that's about $200 million per biennium now in general fund. If you look at kind of where you are in terms of revenue sources for the coming biennium, And here what I've done is just, I mentioned the third of the time you're one standard deviation or outside that, about 5% you're outside of two standard deviations. Well, in terms of this analysis, you've got the kicker to deal with on the upside, but you're not worried about that in terms of reserve fund usage. So I've just cut that in half. So in other words, that tail that's below, that's one more than one standard deviation below the forecast, and that's about 16%. So you cut that in about half. So if you just apply that and look at what that would be in terms of our 15-17 current projection, that would be about $536 million. So about 16% of the time, based on those numbers, you're going to be more than $500 million off on the downside. You'll be more than $500 million up on the upside, another 16%. If you go two standard deviations, you're looking at about $2.6 billion, and that would be about 2.5% of when that happens. So you can see that in terms of 15-17, your revenue shortfall would be very large for a two-standard deviation event, $536 million, which may be manageable, but certainly more so than what we've seen in the past, but that would be for one-standard deviation. If we wait until 17-19, your reserves are growing, but of course that becomes more and more risky that we'll have a recession between now and that time. So if you look at the recommendations that were made in the Pew study, and I put that on OLIS, I think it's a good study because it really does update kind of how states are looking at things and kind of best practices in the wake of the Great Recession. Really, not just the Great Recession, but a whole decade and a half, really, of greater volatility. Require regular studies. I think that's something that is done both here in the Office of Economic Analysis on what those sources of volatility. I think we know what they are. We just looked at them. The twin evils of the corporate volatility and capital gains. Two of the major suggestions they make, and these I think get back into some of the proposals that were developed by the chair and Senator Morse over the last few years. One explicit recommendation they made was to tie the budget stabilization fund deposits to observed volatility. So you would tie it to some basis of the standard deviation or variation you normally see in that forecast cycle to make sure that you fill your stabilization funds up to that level. So you can see some of the beginnings of that when you start to do that kind of a risk analysis and calculating what it is. I think the most important recommendation in terms of for you to think about going into the session is this notion that of establishing these size targets to match the state's experience with volatility. So if you can begin to pull out some of these volatile revenue sources such as capital gains, corporate, you've pulled that out a bit, you can look at some trend growth rate over time, and when you exceed that trend, you realize that that's not sustainable because you know that the valley's coming at some point. So to develop a mechanism in terms of filling up your reserve fund, what Pew is arguing is you find a way to capture a portion of those volatile revenue sources and set them aside in terms of reserves, to build your reserves, because you know those sources are not going to stay at that level. So that's there's some bills. I know Senator Hass and Representative Reed are working on a bill to look at that. You do have the constitutional confusion caused by the kicker law and exactly how much latitude you have in terms of pulling things out of the general fund. But that would certainly be one approach you could do. Would be, you know where your volatile sources are, to find a way to pull those out and set them aside when you know they're growing beyond what their long-term average is.
Yeah, that would help a lot.
So.
And I've seen the presentation of this Pew report, and I recommend it to anyone who may be listening out there, because it really is a good comprehensive, and you did a good job summarizing it. So thank you. And I think that completes our business, unless anybody has any questions. Thank you for sticking through to the bitter end, committee and audience. Okay. Anything else?
That's it.
Okay. We're adjourned.
Merry Christmas.
What?
Your LC draft?
No, we're not going to do it.
Okay.
Oh, we are adjourned.
Is there another one?
There was another one. If there was confusion.
The bill to end all bills.
The bill to end all bills, yeah. To end all bills, yeah.